Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1998, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a writer. Born in Liverpool and brought up in Wales, she was married for 40 years to a publisher, became the mother of 7 children, and didn't put pen to paper herself until she was 42. She's made up for it since. She's now written more than 20 books, mainly novels, as well as regular journalistic columns, and is regarded as one of this country's best writers. Eccentric, fond of a drink and the odd expletive, she's also a devout and traditional Catholic, deeply opposed to the liberal movement in her church. The basic lesson, she says, is to put other people first. If there's a manky orange and a nice one, you have the manky one. She is Alice Thomas Ellis. Do you manage to live according to your own lessons then, Alice, or are you a secret good orange snaffler?
I would take the manky orange. I wouldn't enjoy it, but I think I'd try and take it.
But is that because somebody might see you if you took the good one and think the worse of you? Is that why?
No, it's because my conscience would give me bother.
But you'd feel guilty?
I'd feel guilty, yes.
It's not very fashionable, though, is it? Don't you think that people look at you strangely sometimes these days when you do something as selfless as that?
Well, I think they think it's unhealthy. I think aren't we meant to love ourselves first and then everybody else will love us?
And self-esteem, I think, is the order of the day.
Well, I don't think that's a very rational point of view.
So you aspire to be good. Did you always aspire to be a writer? Because as I've just said in the introduction, you didn't write until you were 42.
No, but I think it's like that story of the little boy who didn't talk for years and years and years. And then one day he said, "Mama, I did not greatly care for the cocoa tonight." And she said, "But darling, that's amazing. You've never talked before. Why did you never speak before?" And he said, "Well, everything's been all right up until now."
So what was the catalyst? What made you suddenly find your voice, your pen?
I was just so angry with what had happened in the church after Vatican II. When, of course, it was the 60s, and I think everything went a bit mad. And I was just... Well, I felt bereft and angry, and so I had to do or say something.
But can you explain that? What were you angry about?
I was angry about the way they'd... they'd changed everything without much as a by your leave. They decided that they were going to alter the Mass, the liturgy, everything, and just... gone ahead and done it. I mean, the first time I started going to church after it had all happened, I didn't know where I was. I didn't even recognise the church as a Catholic church.
So there was that anger, but was there also a kind of anger about what we think of as characterising the 60s as well? You know, sort of free love and high-rise living and...
I just thought everybody had gone completely nuts. And, of course, that was awkward because, you know, everybody's out of step but our Charlie. You think, well, if I think everybody's gone mad, perhaps it's me. But I really didn't like the 60s at all.
So you published The Sin Eater in 1977, which was a kind of portrait of a kind of contemporary British life, wasn't it?
Yes.
And Rose, the main character, was she very much you, do you think? She was deeply disenchanted with the Catholic Church, of course.
Well, she said what I thought, but apart from that, I don't think I'm very like her. She did things. I don't think I'd actually do things. I might think... ungenerous thoughts, but I would try not to put them into action.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, the first is Billie Holiday singing For All We Know. And this is just because I think it's so beautiful when her voice is nearly gone. It's so poignant.
For all we know, we may never meet again. Before you go, make this moment sweet again.
Billie Holiday with the Ray Ellis Orchestra singing For All We Know. Alice Thomas Ellis is in fact your pen name. Why did you... Your real name's Anna Haycraft. Why did you adopt a pen name? Why do you want one?
Well, I thought it would make me invisible.
From whom?
Well, from everybody, really. I thought I could be completely anonymous and sort of stand there, you know, roaring, really, complaining about what was going on and never have to answer personally for any of my opinions, but it didn't work like
never that. Never have to stand up in your kitchen and sort of put the argument face-to-face with somebody.
That's what I didn't want to do.
But it didn't work?
Didn't work.
So do you regard them as two different people, Anna and Alice, or are you...?
Well, I think I do, rather. I don't like Alice very much. Just never really warmed to her. I think I lack self-esteem, or I lack the self-esteem that Alice might like to have had. I don't know.
Religion, as we've already established, is a very strong theme in your life. It runs all the way through it. And, in fact, I think you were probably 19, 20, when you nearly became a nun.
Well, I did for a time. I was a postulant. And then I got a slip disc. And it was very nasty. I hadn't realised, you know, these things could be quite so painful. And I had to go into hospital and I was on traction and they said I'd never be any use, certainly in an active order. And so I left and that was that.
But why did you want to become a nun? What drove you? Was it were you seeking calm or was it intellectual fulfilment? What was it?
It seemed the quickest way home, at its simplest.
Can you enlarge on that?
Well, I mean, people say this life isn't a rehearsal. I think it is. And I wanted, really, to get it over quickly and get to where I wanted to be.
But why did you think of that as home? Your parents weren't Catholic, were they?
No, my papa was a humanist. But a lot of my family were Catholic, and I had, as it were, been exposed to Catholicism. And it just seemed to me the total logical way to live your life with that end in view of getting back to God.
So having solitude, being in a private place, being able to be at peace with yourself is quite profoundly important to you.
It's very important.
So Alice Thomas Ellis, Anna Haycraft on a desert island is complete paradise then?
Well, it is really, yes. As long as there are no snakes.
Tell me about your second record.
Well, the second record is... I'm not very good at music. I don't really like music very much. I'm not what you'd call good music. But the music I think I love most of all is plain song. And I've got some friends at Downside Abbey, and so I thought I would like to take their version of Gregorian plain chant.
Monks of Downside Abbey singing a Gregorian chant, Rorate Caeli De Super. The other thing we know, or think we know, about Alice Thomas Ellis, if we've read her writings, is that she's Welsh, but it turns out she's not. She's Liverpudlian.
Well, half Liverpudlian, half Welsh. My mum was Welsh, and my father's father was Finnish.
But do you remember anything about Liverpool, pre-war?
Yes, I do. I just have some rather vague memories. And oddly enough, they seem to be of things like pool halls. I do remember people playing billiards. And I remember the smell of breweries and the sound of those huge horses and wagons. And I know, oh, if we ever went back, when I was still a child, I used to absolutely hate it. I hated that sense of crowd and noise.
Because you fell in love with the countryside.
By then, I'd fallen in love with the countryside, yes.
You were evacuated to Wales, right?
Yes.
And what was it you fell in love with there, then?
It was simply so beautiful and so peaceful, and it was the setting for a perfect childhood. I mean, there were dangers. If you went too far over the mountain or fell off a cliff, that wasn't a good idea, and, you know, there was the sea with all the implicit dangers in the sea. But apart from that, we used to just roam absolutely free.
What about school?
Well, first I went to the National School in Penmyn Mawr, which was wonderful. Terribly well taught. And then I went on to the grammar school in Bangor.
You've said since, I can think of no better start in life for a person who's going to end up a writer as that early schooling. Why? What happened? What did you get from it?
Well, the teachers, they knew the district, they knew the locality, all the legends, all the local stories. And that brought, certainly history to life.
But what kinds of legends and stories?
There was talk of the phantom funerals and the corpse candles. It was still talked about.
And how much do you believe in it?
There was certainly something there. There are too many eyewitness accounts. It
of,
went on for
of what kind long. Of thing?
Well, the phantom funerals, where somebody would see a funeral procession where there was nothing, and then a week later somebody would die, and the procession would take exactly that route and exactly that form. And there were corpse candles, sort of little blue lights used to flicker at people's gateways. That was bad news. And there was the Derren y Meirw, which was the bird of death, and he'd come banging on the window. And I think most people believe in that. When the bird bangs on the window, that's not good news either.
Your latest novel, The Fairies, is very much about this kind of thing. And it's about a changeling baby that's given to a girl who goes to live in Wales. For someone who's so deeply religious, you obviously believe or feel there's something in the supernatural. You're not supposed to have anything to do with all that stuff, are you?
Well, no, I have to make allowances for myself there.
But, I mean, have you seen ghosts? Do you believe
in ghosts? I've heard them. There's a sort of knocking that we get from the barns. But I don't mind it. If there is anything there, I don't think it's hostile.
Record number 3.
Oh, this is Paul Robeson singing the canoe song, and it's from the film Sanders of the River. And I saw this, I must have been very young, it was when we were in Wales, and at that time all I wanted to do was grow up and be Paul Robeson. That wonderful voice.
Paul Robeson singing the canoe song from the film Sanders of the River. Grammar school in Bangor, art college in Liverpool, then the failed attempt to become a nun in Sussex, and then at the age of 22 you found a husband. How did you do that?
Well, I'd somehow ended up in Chelsea by that time, staying with friends. And I had a friend who was just opening a delicatessen. Very good cook. She was called Francoise. But her meat pies and her apple pies were identical. And this chap came in one day, bought one or the other and took it home. Then he came back the next day and said he'd ordered a meat pie and he'd ordered an... What had he ordered? It was one or the other, he got it wrong, and he put either gravy or custard on, whichever it was supposed not to be. Then we got married about, not more than a couple of months later.
And you had lots of children. I mean, pretty relentlessly, really. About every 18 months, I think, didn't you, for a while?
Yes.
There's a kind of contradiction at first glance there, isn't there? This girl who wanted to be a nun suddenly enters relentless motherhood. Or do you think there's something in common, strangely?
Oh, I think it's very similar because a lot of those nuns have terrific motherly capacities.
There's also the matter of discovering the love of a mother. Mother love, isn't there? I mean, did you get hooked on that quite quickly?
Well, it came as the most amazing surprise to me because I'd never felt like that about anybody, and then suddenly there was this baby. And then you'd die for it or you'd kill for it. And I don't think you ever felt like that previously about anything.
But it is a huge thing, as we're saying, the love of a mother. So the death of a child is completely terrible, and it's something you've had to experience twice, isn't it?
Yes, it's the... I sometimes think the death of my son is, in a way, the only thing that ever happened to me, because everything else is so insignificant in comparison.
Because he was 19.
He was 19.
And he fell from a roof in Euston Station. He was train spotting, wasn't he?
Yes.
We should say that the other child you lost was 2 days old.
I was 2 days old, and I thought that was the worst thing, and I missed her absolutely, dreadfully. But then I'd known Joshua for 19 years, and that was just such a blow.
I suppose we just don't expect to be predeceased by our children, really. It's just not something we're prepared for, is it?
No.
Can never be?
Never.
Is it something you can ever get over, or does it...
No, you don't get over it. You learn to live with it. But you never, ever... And if you have a limb amputated, it doesn't grow again. You're never completely whole again.
Even if you believe as deeply as you do that when someone dies, they go to a better place and that you'll meet them again one day and all this, is there no comfort?
Oh, that's the only consolation. And it's also quite interesting because when something like that happens... and I think we always perceive death as a threat. And then if you lose somebody you love very much, it becomes much more of a promise that there will be a fitting ending to all the pain, that you will see them again, that you will somehow know what it's all been about. You'll come to a state of understanding.
Record number 4.
Well, this is... a song called His Eyes on the Sparrow. And I heard it, first of all, in a film. I think it was a member of The Wedding. In one of my depressed moods, and somebody took me out to see this film. I don't remember much about that. But I found this song very cheering. And also it now reminds me of Joshua's nurse, Lillian, in the hospital, who was a coser, and who was one of the most good people I've ever met in my life. She had complete authority in that ward, and she was capable of complete compassion. And she was one of the only good things that came from that terrible time.
And have you remained friends with her?
Yes.
And I know he watches over me.
Mikael Brown singing His Eyes on the Sparrow from Jack Levin's 1977 musical Bubbling Brown Sugar. Lillian the nurse is not the only person you've adopted in your life. I think there's simply quite a few of them. Didn't you adopt as a godfather to one of your children a young man you caught burgling your house?
Well, that's Alfred. He was only about 9 or 10 at the time he burgled the house, but he broke in with a lot of his little friends. We were having the house rebuilt, so it looked like a bomb site. So they thought there was nobody there. And they were in the habit of going round looking for places like this. And they'd take any sort of furniture or unconsidered trifles. And then they'd go off to various fences and sell them and get money for sweeties. And, of course, I caught the littlest one. And then he burst into tears. So gave him a sandwich and sent him off. And then he came back and he's been more or less with us ever since.
That first novel we were talking about, The Sin Eater, was published, in fact, when Joshua was in hospital, wasn't he? It turned out that he'd dedicated it to himself, hadn't he?
Yes, I noticed. It was before he fell. I found the manuscript one day and he'd put on it to Josh. And then he fell, so of course it was to Josh after that.
But obviously life became completely different after that. I mean, you were a different person. You were a woman who'd lost one of her sons, and you were a novelist. Was there solace in the one for the other, as it were? Did your writing help?
I think it probably did. I think when you have a bereavement like that, I think you go mad. We each have to bear it, I suppose, in our own way. But doing something, it does help. It's not that it takes your mind off it, but it gives your mind something else to chew on, as it were.
Record number five.
This is Tom Lehrer, and this is Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, and it's got this gleeful anarchy about it that I find very, very engaging. Also, Geoffrey Bernard used to absolutely hate pigeons. He said they were flying rats.
Spring is here, a suffering is here. Life is skittles and life is beer. I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring. I do, don't you? Of course you do. But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park.
Tom Lehrer, Poisoning Pigeons in the Park. I'm glad we sort of paused for a laugh, because I've just got the feeling we might have made you sound too somber a person. So, and that when, in fact, as I say, there's this witty side to your life, and you... If your column in The Spectator was to be believed, there was a kind of eccentric chaos to your life. I mean, do you plead guilty to that?
Well, it seemed to be perfectly normal. And a lot of people did say, gosh, that's exactly how it is in our place. And I never exaggerated. I mean, sometimes people would say, well, it can't be like that. And I'd think, well, you don't know the half of it.
But what form does the chaos, or did the chaos take? Or is it still there, the chaos?
It is a bit, yes. But if you've got a large family and you all live together, I think chaos is inevitable to some extent.
But sort of cats lost around the house, shut in bedrooms, mislaid manuscripts.
Well, the other day my son was in the country, in the barn, and a sheep leapt through the window. It wasn't open, the window, it just came through the glass. Maybe if you sort of get about a bit, or even just live a normal domestic life, the most extraordinary things do happen.
It does sound a bit, I have to say, it sounds a bit like sort of life in a novel, a sort of Margaret Drabble novel, you know, life in a North London kitchen with kind of friends and novelists called Beryl popping in.
You should come home for lunch with me now and have a look.
And see what it's like.
Yes.
But in your novel, The Fairies, there are two women, and I wondered if they did have anything to do with you and Beryl Bainbridge, because it's sort of two women who live in London, who have a very close relationship. I mean, a lot of familiarity, a bit of contempt. The vodka bottle or sort of ice is clinking in the glasses, you know, as they tootle down to Wales to sort of try and sort things out. And
well, it is... In a way, it's my relationship with my female friends. I think women friends are enormously important, yes.
What do you think they give you, then? How would you sum it up?
Well, a lot of the time, they make you laugh. I think that's very important. Of course, men can be very funny, but I sometimes get the feeling that they've got a rather gloomy undercurrent that things are going to get worse, and women seem to me to be able to put that aside.
And there's a woman called Janet who came as a nanny years ago and has never gone away since.
Well, now she's just part of the family.
You adopted her too?
Yes, it's just as simple as that.
Next record.
Oh, this is You've Got to Have Heart. I think it's from Damn Yankees. It hits some note, and it gets Janet too, and if we chance to hear it on the radio, then we break into a little song and dance routine.
Mister, you can be a hero. You can open any door. There's nothing to it but to do it. You gotta have heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course. But keep that old horse before the cart. First, you gotta have heart.
Russ Brown singing Heart from the 1955 musical Damn Yankees. So we get this picture, Alice Thomas Ellis, of a really rather liberal, comfortable person who isn't averse to the odd temptation. And then we hear that she's taken on the Catholic establishment, that she's really very stern about her religion, and that she's gone on the attack against an archbishop who's hardly cold in his grave. This was 1996, and you attacked the recently deceased Archbishop Derek Warlock of Liverpool. Why did you choose that moment to sound off?
Well, I didn't. There was nothing personal. I didn't have a go at Derek Warlock at all. But Liverpool had been without an archbishop for some time, and a lot of my chums in Liverpool were very worried. They didn't really want another liberal, for want of a better term. And I had tried and tried and tried to see Derek Warlock, and he just wouldn't talk to me. And I tried for years to get a sort of rise out of the establishment, out of the hierarchy. I wanted them to tell us what was going on.
This is trying through your column.
Trying through the column, yes. Herald. And I'd write and I'd telephone and be this appalled silence, and they wouldn't talk to me. And all I said was, I don't know, something like, I hope we don't have another liberal, pointing out that mass attendance in Liverpool had dropped. I mean, you know, so much. While he was there, and vacations had fallen off. But I think it was the editor in the Catholic Herald who chose the headline, My War with Warlock, which really put the cat among the pigeons.
Yes, but you did go on the attack. I mean, you said some pretty stern, as I say, things in that article.
I'd been doing it for years, but I'd been getting no response.
Well, because I think a lot of people felt that Derek Warlock and his Anglican counterpart, David Shepherd, had actually been rescuing Liverpool from all kinds of sectarian and racial prejudice and possible violence and so on, that they were doing a grand job.
Well, it's all very fine and large, but I don't think there was ever much tension between the Catholics and the Anglicans. I mean, there were sort of religious riots in Liverpool ages ago, but that was the Catholics and the Orange Order.
Yes, but as David Shepherd said at the time, you know, the church had enough problems without one Christian slagging off another. Why did you lay in at that moment?
Because I was still looking for a response to our questions. You know, what is happening? Why is the church being, as it were, dismantled in this way?
But you knew what the response was, that it was in the best interests of the ecumenical movement.
That's what they always say.
But do you really believe that the Catholic Church shouldn't attempt to make any allowances for the 20th century, for the equality of women or for family planning by contraception, if not by abortion? I mean, surely if it doesn't address the realities of life, then its congregations do and will diminish.
No, they only diminished after Vatican II had been, well, more or less hijacked by the progressives and the modernists.
That was the 1960s?
Yes, but an enormous amount of heresy crept into the church then.
But I wonder why it falls to you to be so stern about it. Why do you have to fight this corner? One can't help feeling it's kind of zeal of the convert.
No, I was more or less elected to bell the cat because there are thousands of us who feel as I do.
But you got sacked as a result.
I got sacked, yes. No, I was Muggins, you see. I didn't mind.
You didn't mind at all?
No.
Record number 7.
This is Nancy Kerr singing The Great Silky. It's a song for enticing seals. And I just thought if I was on a desert island and I got lonely, I could put this on and some seals might come and visit.
In Norway there lived a maid, by Lou my baby she begins. All on a time babe's father, or if land or sea is living in. Then there arose at her bedside.
Nancy Kerr singing The Great Silky. You almost, I thought, began to say earlier on that you might still consider becoming a nun.
Oh, yes, I think about it a lot.
You don't think you've developed too many worldly ways to be acceptable?
No, the only thing that gives me pause is they do keep the most awful hours. They get up terribly early in the morning. And having had all those children and all those broken nights and absolutely no time to sleep, I really do like a lion if I feel like it.
You said that we should try to be selfless, but it doesn't seem to me that you believe we should expect to be happy. That happiness is a kind of bonus if it happens.
Well, that's what I think. I think we're not put here to be happy. I think it's absolutely pointless to go looking for it.
What are we here for, then, if it's not to be happy?
The Penny Catechism said to love and serve God in this world and be happy with him forever in the next, at its simplest.
Does writing make you happy?
No, it makes me a bit more contented, I think.
What makes you happiest, then?
Oh, moments of peace.
But in your life, how often does that happen?
More frequently now. I don't get as depressed as I used to. Also, I think having more time to myself makes me very much more contented, peaceful.
Last record.
Oh, this is Gracie Field singing The House is Haunted. And I first heard this years and years and years ago. I was staying in the Lake District. It was a house on Windermere. I used to play this record, and it used to sort of float out across the lake, and it sounded absolutely wonderful. It reminds you of my youth.
Does it remind you at all of your husband, who died a few years ago?
Well, of course, there is that. It's just that it says very much what one tries not to go on about.
I hate to be alone when evening falls. I'm so afraid of all these empty halls, doors and walls. The house is haunted by the echo of your last goodbye.
Gracie Fields and The House is Haunted. If you could only take one of the 8 records, I wonder which one it would be.
It would be The Plain Song.
And what about your book, as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
Well, there's an anthology called Come Hither, Walter de la Mer, which is full of poems. And then at the end, it's got these wonderful notes and asides and little observations. I think I'd take that.
And your luxury?
Well, of course, I would have said a sort of portable bar with, you know, vodka and cigarettes. And I thought that's too babyish and self-indulgent.
And might make you feel better, though.
Yes, but there wouldn't be a lot of cocktail parties. I probably wouldn't need it. And then I thought, well, what I really like is a very comfortable sofa. I think that would be perfect.
Anna Haycroft, a.k.a. Alice Thomas Ellis, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.